This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Well,
good morning. We didn't decide who was going to start first. Hello and good morning. The doctor's lounge is open. The coffee is hot. The doctors are talking in the studio this morning. I am your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchak.
And I'm Dr. Hal Schurz.
And we have David Moxley on the board running the show for us. Thank you, David.
And I'd also like to publicly thank David for his help and support. And I'd like to thank our listening audience. This is sort of a semi-annual or half-year anniversary show, and it's the beginning of the new year, and we thought we would bring to you some of the top stories of 2014 in healthcare and make some predictions for 2015. But first, let me tell you that our show is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is a tax-deductible, not-for-profit charity. It's doctor-led, and it's about you, our patients. I'm a board member of the foundation, and we're dedicated to fighting for healthcare freedom in America, something that all of us have taken for granted, but it's quickly slipping away as the federal government gets more involved in healthcare. And we fight for the doctor-patient relationship, something that is intrinsic to good healthcare, but it's being undermined and eroded and potentially lost forever.
Part of what we seek to do for you, the listener, is to sort of reacquaint you with who doctors really are, how we think, you know, what the calling of medicine really is and should be, and sort of, you know, fight against, as Hal just talked about, sort of this tide of depersonalization and commoditization and commercialization. And hopefully part of what you get out of the time that we spend together is a renewed understanding of what it means to be a doc and what it means to take care of people and how this is different than banking and the airlines and the groceries and stores and other places where the economy has become so changed by my kind of pet thing, information technology, and that we need to understand medicine is different.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of a treat for me. I enjoy being in the studio with you, Mike.
We have
not really had very many opportunities to do this because we have very busy medical practices, and it's hard for us to get here even once a week or every other week, let alone every week. So this is always a treat to be able to have a repartee with you live in the studio.
Absolutely. And always mutual.
We talked before the show about show prep, what we were going to talk about, the top stories of 2014. And
yes.
I think that many of the stories that we've talked about, top healthcare stories for 2014, center around Obamacare. But when I thought about this a little bit more, you know, that Obamacare is clearly the number one healthcare story of 2014.
Sure, and a lot of sort of sub-stories fall under that heading, to be sure.
Yes, but you know what really was the big story healthcare other than Obamacare in 2014? It was Ebola.
Yes, indeed.
It was Ebola.
In many, many aspects. I mean, this is the first time in you know, easily rememberable history for most of us that a disease outbreak or the threat of an outbreak really had us kind of scared right down to our bones as to where this was going to go. And there were a few days in there where, you know, folks who had flown with the nurse that had, you know, asked the CDC, "Can I fly?" "Yes, you can." So she did. And that a whole bunch of people in an aircraft, you know, with all that recirculating air and everything else, were potentially infected. And I think we all held our breath for a while wondering what was going to happen to that.
Literally.
You know, held our breath. And thankfully, you know, nothing came of that.
Right.
And so we learned a great deal, I think, about the difference between how a disease behaves in one sort of society versus how it behaves in another kind of society with different practices and different, you know, levels of technology for hygiene and that kind of thing. And, you know, thankfully it appears at least that the threat has pretty much passed. But I think we learned a great deal at a number of levels, including how our government behaves, yet again, a recurring theme. But yes, I think the Ebola, you know, has its scientific side, and it has its, you know, political and government side.
Yeah. And we devoted a couple of shows to that subject. That's how impactful that issue was. Another big healthcare story, and we'll just kind of just mention these just to get them off the table so that we can focus on the meat the red meat of healthcare. But another big story that came out, one that you devoted an entire show to, was Joan Rivers.
Yes, indeed. Yes, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the Joan Rivers thing if you're a doc.
Yeah, that was a huge story, because what it really the take home message from that and you really highlighted this issue as well as anybody that I've ever heard talk about this, is that doctors are really starstruck. And they don't behave like they should when they get a celebrity in their practice.
Well,
they're not in power anymore.
Well,
doctors
are human beings too, Hal.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I see a fair number of these folks. It's not a novelty to me anymore. But, you know, if the right person, you know, comes across my doorstep, I have the potential to just become a drooling fan like anybody else. And it's very difficult in those situations, especially when they ask you for things. You know, they do two things. One is they hold you up to you and say, oh, you're wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you, doctor, for saving me, or, you know, doing whatever. They tend to over-dramatize these things. And then in the next breath, they're asking for something. And I related the story. I won't go through the whole thing again. But saying no to these folks is one of the hardest things that I've ever had to do when duty calls for that.
And the take-home message is that this is not a unique situation. It's very highly publicized, but it'll happen again.
Well, you know, just about any doc is at some point you're going to have somebody like this come across your doorstep, and you have to be careful, because just like you said, Hal, the whole, you know, doctor-patient relationship is turned upside down. Instead of the patient coming and asking for guidance and you offering guidance, oftentimes they come in with already knowing what they want or having their own sort of practices on how they fix what they have, and they're just asking you to be an enabler. And, yeah. You know, if what they want to do is harmless enough, I mean, one time I had somebody who, you know, if I mentioned their name, you'd immediately know them, who said that, you know, they like taking, you know, a half a milligram of Decadron, right? So you and I both know that's like a homeopathic dose. You want to do that? Fine. I had no problem with that. But, you know, my theory, and again, it's unsubstantiated, but theory is that Joan Rivers asked them to do what was done.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want the publicity of a surgery center. She wouldn't have to walk through, you know, TMZ reporters and National Enquirer and all that kind of stuff, and wanted it to be done, you know, sort of on the sly.
Which is why a doctor who didn't have privileges in his center risked their career coming in and doing something, because they were probably put on the spot.
Well, and that particular ENT doctor, and this is a thought that came to me later after I did the show, Hal, is that if celebrity patients are all you do, then you really don't have much choice, right? In the situations where I've had to say no, I've had to say, okay, I'm mentally prepared to lose that patient. I'm mentally prepared for them to go, forget it. If you're not going to do for me what I want, I'm going to go somewhere else. You know, in my situation, it's only a small percentage of what I do. So if I lose it, I lose it, but it's not a disaster. This particular ENT, I think, was the doctor to the stars. That's all she did.
Right.
And if she didn't, you know, if it went through the performance community that she wasn't coming through anymore,
There
goes her practice. It's all over. So I think he was really caught.
So those were the two big standout stories in healthcare for 2014 that other than Obamacare that kind of hit me I remember dominated the newspapers and in fact dominated our time here in the station we devoted shows to those.
Well, there's a couple other little ones that are bigger than they appeared, right? And I think you talked about some of these the week before I spent more time on Ebola, which is the enterovirus D68, right? Has actually killed more people on American soil than Ebola.
It has.
And I think 13 people died, I think was the number that is out there. But, you know, that was a scary thing too, but it was kind of happening in the shadow of Ebola.
Yes, it was. And it's something that you just mentioned a few minutes ago, really is the soft underbelly of our healthcare system and political system, where they kind of come together.
Yes. And that interface, you know, the CDC is supposed to be managing that interface.
Right.
And, you know, clearly there's some work to be done.
Well, we talked about that on, you know, on previous show, which is available online on the podcast, where we explored what the CDC is and how it has changed over time and no longer is the independent and reliable agency that it once was.
Agreed.
You know, somewhat similar to you know, some of our you know, federal law enforcement, like the Secret Service, for example, which no longer is an independent standalone agency, but part of Homeland Security. They've lost their imprimatur of being, you know, the elite of the elite.
Yes.
So
yes,
let's go ahead and dive right into the Obamacare stuff. So, you know, I think that the biggest story of the year was the landslide election in November, where Republicans swept to victories in state, in federal elections, in local elections, all across the country in greater numbers, and at least at the federal level, most of the people who ran on a platform anti-Obamacare.
Absolutely. And Obama, you know, set his own trap when, you know, he proclaimed, again, probably more ego-driven than brain-driven, I suspect, to say that the entire midterm election was a referendum on his stuff, which, you know, completely sabotages the ability of individual politicians to separate themselves from the failures of his policies and try to run on their own merits. You know, now they were shackled to it.
And people were experiencing the sticker shock at the same time of increased health care costs for insurance, for copays, for deductibles, and loss of access to health care. They've lost their doctors, they've lost their insurance. In many cases, they've lost hours at work because their employers did not want to cover their health care costs if they worked for more than 30 hours, which is the new definition of full-time employment under Obamacare. So they've cut their hours from 40 hours to 29 hours. And
absolutely,
so people have had to look for two jobs in order to make ends meet.
Well, talk about inefficiency, right? Instead of working one full-time job, now you have to work two part-time jobs.
Yes.
And, you know, conceivably, you know, chase all over town to get enough money to keep a roof over your head and food on the table just so you can be classified as part-time.
And this is Obamacare.
This is the face of it.
This is, and it's just beginning. And then, you know, we've all learned that you cannot keep your own doctor, you cannot keep your own insurance, you cannot get your health care where you previously were getting it because the rules of the road have all changed.
And then, you know, everyone's getting their nose rubbed in this ugly concept that an insurance card doesn't equal coverage. And that's another myth that's been put out by the supporters of Obamacare and big government that, you know, if we put a card in your hand, whether it's a Medicaid card or a card from an exchange or what have you, that somehow that's mission accomplished, right? We've succeeded. We finished. Not that last step of actually using that card to see somebody and get what's ailing you looked at.
And seniors have felt this because so many of them are losing their doctors because right now 30% of physicians in this country are no longer seeing new Medicare patients. They're in the poor community, in some places, there are no Medicaid providers. Texas physicians have I think the number is 60% for Texas physicians that are not seeing any new Medicaid patients. So access to care has significantly worsened under the implementation of Obamacare.
You know, and even in our own experience, in our own practice, sometimes it's not even the rates. You know, even if you overlook this huge issue that they're paying you less than it costs you to take care of a patient, that the internal operations of some of these Medicaid providers is so poor that it's taking, you know, months to do something as simple as credentialing. You know, we're having issues where we can't even get docs credentialed under some of the Medicaid providers in Georgia just because their internal workings are so poor. And I don't know if you remember how years ago when Medicaid switched its computer system and they went for 6 months and didn't pay anybody.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can't do business with people who operate their business in such a poor manner. It doesn't work. We're coming up on the end of the first segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock for Medicine on Call. On Medicine on Call, we talk about more than medicine. It's about how to take control of your mind, body, and spirit.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. In the studio this morning are myself, your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchak.
And Dr. Hal Schertz with our board operator, David Moxley. And we were talking about the top stories of 2014 and recapping what those healthcare stories are. Mike, you know, one of the big stories that is actually an ongoing story for 2015 is the Supreme Court challenge to Obamacare. This was a lawsuit that started with the with Oklahoma. The Attorney General in Oklahoma challenged the validity of the federal exchanges. Now, the law was written. It was very explicit what it said. It said that the subsidies that people who sign up for Obamacare are getting, they are eligible for them if they enroll in a healthcare policy that is in a state-run exchange. Well, 33 states chose not to implement state-run exchanges, so the federal government stepped in and ran those exchanges for the states. Well, that is in direct conflict with the law, and the executive branch is maintaining that this is the spirit of the law, that this is that they can give subsidies to people on federal-run exchanges in various states because that's really what Congress intended when they passed the law. Well, the other side of the argument and the contention, which has been substantiated by many people who were involved in drafting the law, was that they purposely said state-run exchanges because they were trying to strong-arm the states to implement the exchanges. And so they thought that if they put that in, that would encourage the states to go ahead and start the exchanges. But the states fought back, and they resisted, and they said, no, we're not going to do it. So the federal government stepped in, and now we have an impasse over language. And the Supreme Court challenges that the federal government is overstepping their bounds by allowing people on those exchanges to get subsidies. And 33 states have joined that lawsuit, which the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. They fast tracked it, so it's going to be heard in April,
and probably a decision in late June. Yes, is how that calendar usually works.
That's exactly right.
But I guess it was actually kind of a big deal that they decided to actually hear that case, because there was, you know, a combination of rulings in lower courts that made that not totally certain. Correct?
Yes, there was a split decision. One court, it was a 2-1 decision. That was for the state position. In another court, it was a 2-1 decision against. And, you know, I think this just speaks of the political nature of judiciary appointees. If the court is packed with people who are more liberal, they are going to be partisan and perhaps not as objective as they need to be.
Legislating from the bench, if you will.
Absolutely right. But, you know, the whole... This whole canard about the law, about you can keep your doctor, about what the federal government intended to do, I guess this was all just put out there on public display in 2014 by Jonathan Gruber.
Oh yes, this is a hard fought example of finally giving the arrogance of government and the academic intelligentsia with whom they work a face and a name. It's difficult to communicate what many of us already know, that this has been going on all along, that we had chin scratching, beard stroking intellectuals telling the rest of us how to live, and that it was okay for thee but not for me.
Mike, for the one person or two people out there who don't know who Jonathan Gruber is, just tell them what this is all about.
Jonathan Gruber is an academician. He is an economist at MIT, who, depending on who you believe, but clearly the evidence shows that he was a major architect of Obamacare.
Despite
he was paid a huge amount of money.
Despite the fact that now publicly people who had contact with him on a regular basis, like Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, they don't know who he is now.
Harry Reid or Barack Obama.
Yeah.
They may have, heard of him.
What, that guy we paid $400,000 to? Yeah, I don't remember.
The guy who's visited the White House 20-odd times and signed in the White House register?
Yeah, no, don't remember him. No, Senator, I cannot recall.
Right.
Who this person is, but he gives this whole issue a face and a name and a soundbite. That demonstrates.
So what did he call the public? He said
stupid. The American voter was stupid. Obamacare was written purposefully as a difficult to understand bill so that politicians could claim anything that they wanted, and it became very difficult to fact check them. So when Obama said, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, it becomes as difficult as possible to verify that. If they say premiums are going to go down for a family by $2,500 per year, it's very difficult in 2,000 plus pages of the bill itself, plus tens of thousands of pages of stuff written by HHS, that you can't decode this, so they have the ability to claim whatever they want to.
And he said that they needed to make it purposefully obtuse so that the they can get past what needed to be passed because they knew better. They knew that this is something that was good for America, and regardless of what other people thought, who might have more expertise than them in healthcare, this is something that was important enough for them to lie or to obfuscate or just to, trick and
well,
make.
Yeah, I mean, it's treating the American people like a bunch of 4-year-olds.
Right.
That you say what you need to say to get what you want passed. There's no ethics involved. It's and the ends justify the means because I, the government bureaucrat or academician, I know what's good for you and you don't, and that's the whole flawed paradigm of this whole thing. But then the day came, not so far in the past, that Mr. Gruber, yes, Dr. Gruber, had to face the congressional committee, and
we didn't have to. He actually agreed. There have been people who have declined the invitation to come to the House committees because it's not a subpoena; it's an invitation.
But it could have been upgraded to a subpoena.
I suppose
true.
It could,
so
yes.
It could have been. I mean, yeah, maybe some credit for actually volunteering as opposed to waiting to be subpoenaed. But my impression was, had he refused, he probably would have been subpoenaed. Correct.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So should we play some of this?
Sort oh,
of,
please do.
Let's give a face and a name and a soundbite to some of his testimony, Gruber's testimony to Trey Gowdy and the remainder of the Senate committee or congressional committee.
Gruber, what did you mean when you said they proposed it and that passed because the American people are too stupid to understand the difference?
When I said that, I was at an academic conference being glib and, quite frankly, trying to make myself seem smart by insulting others.
Are you offering the venue as a defense for saying it or for meaning it?
I'm offering it as a defense for using inappropriate and hurtful and excusable language to explain.
Well, what did you mean by too stupid to understand the difference?
Congressman, I didn't mean anything about it by it.
Well, you said it. You had to admit it.
I was once again being glib and trying to make myself seem smarter by reflecting.
Well, what did you mean when you said it was a very basic exploitation of the lack of economic understanding of the American voter? What did you mean by that?
once again, it's another example of...
So you get the idea. Apparently there was 4 hours of this. And so, yes, I think this finally gives us a very important venue to try to expose the truth about how this whole thing was conceived and put to the American people.
And, you know, it's really interesting. Gruber is an MIT elite who has his view of the American public, and this is not unique in the academic world, Mike. This is something that all the academicians, all the academic elite seem to march in lockstep behind Obama. And this happened on every campus around the country, where they would they were rallying in support of Obamacare, and anyone who spoke against it were, you know, quite frankly, either stupid or unpatriotic.
Shouted down.
And, you know, and this sort of takes us into 2015, because just at the beginning of the year, a story broke about the sticker shock of Obamacare. God help me. People actually are being affected by it. Can you imagine that?
And including the Harvard faculty.
Harvard faculty. And why don't you have something to play for us?
Yeah, we have a soundbite from the meeting. This is exclusive audio now from the meeting where the professors at Harvard University were informed that they would have to pay a little bit of their own money, a little bit of deductible, right? A whopping $250 for an individual, $750 for a family. But here was the reaction. Uh-oh, is it going to play? Of course not. There we go. So here you have it. These are the Harvard professors reacting to a little bit of bad news where, you know, they have to practice what they preach.
You know, these people have no idea. They're so disconnected from what mainstream America is feeling as a result of Obamacare. You know, they sit in their offices or at their, you know, faculty clubs, and they talk about what we need to have in America, and then when you get somebody like Obama, who's one of them, who actually gets this implemented, they think it's the greatest thing in the world until it affects them.
Until they have to live with it. And you know, we see that hypocrisy everywhere, right? I mean, in the government, right, you know, congressmen and their staffs don't have to live with Obamacare, although there was a bill introduced that was actually going to make them live with the results. But, yeah, it's great as long as they don't have to practice what they preach for the rest of us.
Well, that's absolutely true. And Do we have any other stories for 2014?
Well, I got a couple little things here based on health information technology. I think, you know, it was an asteroid that narrowly missed the healthcare system when ICD-10 was delayed. And, you know, part of my predictions, or at least hopes for 2015, is that it gets delayed again or somehow altered.
ICD-10 is a new coding scheme. It's actually implemented. It's been implemented in the rest of the world. It's part of what most of the world healthcare community uses. We don't do that in America because there's simply no need to do it. And it's just burdensome, onerous, and it's onerous enough with 17,000 codes, but this new coding system would have taken us to 65,000 codes, and it would have probably paralyzed most physicians' offices. So this takes us to the halftime break in our show on the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is Dr. Hal Schurz.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schurz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. people all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back in the doctor's lounge. This is Hal Schurz.
And I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak.
And we are doing a recap of 2014, and we'll talk about predictions for 2015. We've got one last 2014 story.
Yeah, I just want to throw in one last thing, which was kind of the suppressed story, and I think it's big both because of what it was in health IT and the cover-up, and it had to do with the death of the first Ebola patient to come to America. Remember that story where he came to the hospital, his travel history was entered in the EMR, but that data never made it to the decision makers, and so without the knowledge that he had traveled to West Africa, it just looked like another GI bug, and he was sent home. And of course, by the time he returned, it was too late to save him in retrospect. And there was a very big mistake there made in the EMR system, which was that the information was entered, but, you know, again, despite the health IT community bragging about the concept of clinical decision support, this was an epic failure of that concept. And, because the story was covered up so quickly and the doctors at that hospital came out the following day and said, oh, no, the EMR was fine. It was our fault. My unsubstantiated suspicion is that was coerced at some level. So you have both a story of how a computer can kill a patient and how it was covered up. And, you know, I'm not through with that yet, but that's enough for now.
Okay. Well, you know, that's actually a story that we can talk about, you know, in a whole show. But, let's move on to predictions for 2015. And I think there's two categories of predictions. One are legislative predictions for healthcare. The other are marketplace predictions.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, different worlds.
Exactly. So let's start out by talking about the legislative predictions. What's possible for 2015? And, you know, right now we are in a very unique situation with a Republican-controlled Congress, but a Democrat in the White House who has vowed to veto everything that he doesn't like that comes across his desk.
Threats have already happened.
Exactly. And I don't know whether or not that's going to have any impact on what we actually see implemented, but the GOP has several plans. There are three that have been introduced at the House level, and my guest last week, Dr. Congressman Tom Price, and I talked about some of those plans, one of which he introduced in the Congress two Congresses ago, the Empowering Patient First Act. That's one of the three plans, but all of them are focused on patient-controlled, market-driven solutions. And in the Senate, they had one plan that they sort of coalesced around. It was the Hatch-Coburn-Burr plan, which I particularly did not like as much as the House plans. But I think what's going to happen is that the Republicans in both the House and the Senate bicameral committee, I hope, will come together and coalesce around one plan, because they need to have a plan in place in the event the Supreme Court throws out Obamacare with their decision about the exchanges.
Well, let's flesh that out a little bit, Hal. We talked about that a little bit in the last segment. So if the Supreme Court rules, as I think we hope they do, that the federal exchanges do not qualify for subsidies, what dominoes fall?
Well, the people who are enrolled in the exchanges in those 33 states no longer are eligible for subsidies. So what happens is the true price of the health care insurance plans gets passed along to these individuals. And because Obamacare has artificially changed the playing field, health care insurance has skyrocketed. The insurance plans have had the ability to raise rates astronomically. Their profits in 2014 have been record profits. And now what's going to happen is the patients are going to be subject to 100% of those costs. The sticker shock will be astronomical. They won't be able to afford it. Nobody will have health care insurance.
Just won't be able to afford it.
So there has to be something that's going to be possible, something that will be an alternative to that day one.
And when exactly, and again, this may not be a fair question, but so they rule in late June, and let's say they say, okay, subsidies for federal exchange are null and void. You know, how fast does that actually take effect? I mean, will that be the first of 2016? Is there a few months to try and figure it out? I'm putting Hal on the spot here. That's not a fair question.
Well,
I don't know the answer.
And I don't know the answer myself either, but I suspect that it will be the end of the enrollment period. I suspect that whatever they has been paid for is paid for
right
through that cycle, and then when the new enrollment period starts in
November, then the numbers really come down the pike by then.
Exactly. That's when the rubber meets the road and a plan, really an alternative plan, needs to be in place so that people have options other than not having coverage or having to pay just astronomical amounts of money. And when I say astronomical, I'm talking about one of our friends who comes on the show from time to time. Jeff English was talking with me the other day about his group and the increase in health care insurance for his group and the options. He had one of two choices. He could either go on to stay with his insurance plan, and it would have cost him, for his family of four, close to $16,000, or go on the exchange, and it would have cost him $20,000 because he's not eligible for subsidies.
Oh, nice. So the unsubsidized rates are, as we already know, probably 20-25% higher than what they were to start with.
At least.
And without the subsidies, you know, the ugly truth comes to the surface. But that means that between now, Hal, today and the end of October, let's say, an alternative plan has to be conceived, has to be hammered out, has to pass, and the machinery to make it available by the year end all has to happen in 7 or 8 months.
You know, Mike, I don't think it's as hard as it seems, because the plan is already there. People who have been talking about health care for the last 6 years have the plans already formulated. It's not like they don't exist, although the media would like, or the Democrats would like us to believe that those plans don't exist. They do. It's just a matter of everybody coming together under one plan. And let me just tell you that many of these plans are market-driven. So the marketplace can gear up very quickly to make this happen. If you don't have the government involved in this, and you don't have to, you know, worry about creating a bureaucracy to make certain things occur, you let the market take care of it, things happen very quickly in the market.
Well, what about reconciling some of the different approaches to how to deal with Obamacare, right? You have one approach that, you know, there's apparently a bill in committee that's a two-paragraph bill. Right, it's one page. It says anything that's in the Affordable Care Act is now null and void, basically. Right,
yes.
You have the blow it up approach, and then you have the slow dismantling approach. Right, let's take care of the device tax. Let's take care of the individual mandate.
And I think those things will happen in 2015. Those are going to be bills that will be passed on an individual basis if Obamacare is not blown up by the Supreme Court.
Right,
where they will take out one at a time. They'll dismantle the real bad stuff that there's bipartisan support on.
Agreed. I just, you know, the question is which route do you plan for? Do you plan for the Supreme Court to blow it up, or they've surprised us at least once, if not twice before.
Well, I think you have to plan for the worst and hope for the best, you know, and I don't know if blowing it up isn't hoping for the best, but I do think that if it got blown up, you know, what's the easiest solution right now. You know, I'm not saying that they may not have ready a complete comprehensive solution, but the easiest way would be to free up the marketplace, take the shackles off of doctors, right. Take the shackles off of the insurance companies, yeah. Which have to offer an entire suite of services because the federal government says that you have right. Certain basic things that
there's
need to
a
be
floor
covered,
and,
hair
yeah.
Transplant and acupuncture and herbal therapy.
Right.
You know, these are all things that have to be in an insurance policy. Let people buy what they need in an open marketplace. If there's free trade, if there is an open market, those prices will settle out and there'll be competition.
They have for plastic surgery and LASIK surgery. And if you're outside of healthcare, there's all sorts of examples.
Absolutely. And then let doctors, give them the opportunity to do the things that doctors do well, which beside taking care of patients, which is to innovate. Doctors are tremendously smart people. They're good innovators. But right now, we are under the thumb of the government, and the government has allowed other entities to control doctors like hospitals. And
absolutely.
So right now on the path that we're on, private practice of healthcare is going to disappear. Tom Price and I talked about this last week. 35% of doctors right now are in private practice. And on the path we're on,
which is a sharp decrease, by the way, right? It used to be above 50% just a short couple of years ago.
Actually, in 2010, when the first analysis of this was really being done on a mass scale, 65% of doctors were in private practice. So there are lots of reasons that we've talked about on this show why doctors are leaving private practice and going to work for hospitals. But the biggest reason is because it's gotten impossible to run a practice because of overregulation and underpay, and the Affordable Care Act has created an unlevel playing field where doctors can't compete with the hospitals. And so if you leveled that playing field and you allow doctors now to open up hospitals,
absolutely,
that they can compete against the quote non-for-profit hospitals,
right,
healthcare would be delivered cheaper and better. If you allow doctor groups to get together and figure out ways that they can collaborate and deliver health care more efficiently.
Without fear of inadvertently breaking the law despite the best intentions.
Absolutely.
To stay legal. I mean, you know, simple arrangements that ought to take a couple of months to figure out take 2 years or more in our own experience, simply because it takes an army of lawyers and consultants and accountants, you know, just to satisfy three words, which is make this legal, make
right.
this appropriate.
So I think that there's a lot of legislative possibilities for 2015, and it's just going to depend on, in large part, what happens at the Supreme Court, but also the will of the Congress. You know, there's a lot of money being spread around by interest groups, by insurance companies, by hospitals, by other interests who have a lot to lose if things change from what we have right now. And so it's not necessarily in the best interest of the patients. In fact, it's not in the best interest of the patients to keep things as the status quo. We need to try to get back to the way things were before. But you know, you talk about the IT stuff that's possible. What do you
yes.
think about meaningful use? Is that going to get thrown out, you think?
Well, it's my hope. I don't know that it'll get thrown out. That would be the holy grail.
Tell us what meaningful use is.
Well, meaningful use is a series of incentives and penalties that began about 5 years ago, which gave doctors a fair amount of money. I mean, it looks like a decent amount of money until you compare it to the cost of actually implementing these things, and then it's still a loss. But it was a combination of carrots and sticks, which coerced physicians to implement electronic medical records and to implement them in a certain way, hence the meaningful use term, you know, the government's vision of what health information technology should be. And it basically delayed, you know, true innovation, for several, for the 5 years. So we're coming up on the break. We'll finish this sentence when we come back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to The Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for the fourth and final segment. Thanks for sticking with us. We still have a lot of good stuff to cover, so don't go away. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchak.
And I'm Dr. Hal Schurz, and we are finishing up with the predictions for 2015. Yeah. And so we were talking about some of the legislative things, and then we're going to talk about the marketplace.
So to finish up on the legislative thing, we're talking about meaningful use. And to make a very long story short enough to tolerate, it's a series of incentives and penalties to get docs to use health information technology before it's really ready for prime time, unfortunately. We've progressed from stage one of meaningful use to stage two, which, of course, as you would expect, raises the bar, but stage two has already been delayed once because the health IT vendors, the people who sell the products that we are required by law to buy, didn't have their products ready in 2014. So this was meaningful use stage two was delayed to 2015, but there is now legislation on the table to reduce the reporting period, right? The number of days in calendar year 2015 you need to be compliant with meaningful use stage two down to 90 days. And I hope that happens, or the abysmal participation statistics by doctors for meaningful use two will get even worse. So hopefully that legislation will pass.
What this all means for you out there is that this is taking time away from you. Your doctors are spending more time having to do things that are busy work that have nothing to do with taking care of you. And this is what I mean by taking the shackles off doctors.
Absolutely. And it's an indirect route to, you know, making care more accessible, because the more hours we have to spend doing this kind of stuff, the fewer hours we have to keep our offices open and to see you, our patients, to see you in the office, to do the procedures that you need. And, it's an indirect mechanism, but a very strong one.
It is.
So last but not least, I think we need to talk about this whole concept of maintenance of certification. Now, that's a very lofty term. What exactly does that mean? The concept means that you, doctor, just because you proved at the end of your training that you were a competent physician and you knew the things you needed to know and could answer both written and oral board questions to demonstrate your competence in your selected field of practice, that proving it once is no longer enough. And that every few years, you not only have to take another exam and pay thousands of dollars for the prep course and to take the exam and to travel, again, more time out of your practice, less time for your patients, but you have to present a huge amount of data to these people to demonstrate that you've been practicing and that you've been doing it the right way. And this is a huge burden on physicians that serves absolutely no purpose. You know, the myth that supporters of this, you know, the American board is propagating, is all propaganda. The public is not demanding this.
The American Board of Medical Specialties.
Yes, the ABME. Thank you. That term slipped my head. But yes, you know, this is all, you know, another money-making scheme with winners and losers. And I think if we're talking about predictions for 2015, I think we need to talk about the fact that there is a groundswell growing – to fight this. I think doctors have had enough, and I'd love to see, you know, if it's not a prediction, it's at least a wish.
Well, we had a show on this. I had on this show earlier or late in 2014. Dr. Paul Kempin, who's one of the champions in this movement, anesthesiologist who was formerly at Cleveland Clinic, who had to leave because of his positions on meaningful use. And he informed our audience that this is more than doctors fighting against doctors, even though this is a shakedown by doctors who are skimming money out of the system and scamming other doctors. What it really is, it is a it has a negative effect on our patients because, again, it's taking doctors out of their practices so that they can prepare for these tests, and it's really not helpful at all.
Now, and again, let's be clear, and this is a another example of how the narrative gets controlled by people who want you to believe a certain thing that's not really true. We're not suggesting for a minute that doctors don't need to continue their education. They don't need to keep up on what's new and what's current and what's come out since your formal training was completed.
And it's not even against board certification.
No,
not
at
all.
One
time.
One time. But plus, a certain number of hours, and that's already been in place. That's been in place for 30 years, that you need to have so many education hours per year to maintain your license, to maintain your privileges at the hospital.
Could you imagine if we made people have to maintain their high school diplomas?
I saw that example. I'm not sure where I saw that, but yes, that you needed to, reread Shakespeare and retake your SATs and do all of those
things.
It's just
ludicrous.
It's a classic thing. It's just not one of those things that we should have to burn the resources. And again, those costs get passed on to patients.
It does.
This is not,
That's exactly right. So we're running out of time, and there's still a bit to cover. I think the biggest prediction for 2015 in the marketplace is going to be the emergence of direct primary care practices. There are people who can't afford their health care. The insurance is so expensive, and their deductibles and copays are even more expensive. In some cases, as much as $6,000 for an individual or $12,000 for a family, and that's before the insurance even kicks in. And so this is just, ridiculous. They're paying overinflated prices for underperforming services. And so what is happening around the country, and we've had this show on also in 2014, is direct primary care, where people contract directly with a primary care doctor and they get a suite of services. It's not concierge medicine. It's making a contract with a doctor, and you have access to their practice for an entire array of services, and they also help you get discounted lab, X-ray, specialty services, and then you need to have a wraparound high deductible plan for catastrophic care if, God forbid, you need an operation. And there are people who are developing these kinds of plans all over the country. We're doing that in here in Atlanta. I'm doing that with a few other doctors. We're working on a plan to innovate healthcare and change it entirely. So I think we're going to see the rise of this around the country as it becomes more and more expensive in the traditional third-party insurance model.
And some of the numbers, when you really look at how this works, and Lee Gross made that presentation out in Steamboat back in August, and I didn't understand what the numbers implications of that sort of thing was until I saw those numbers, and I think it was an ER visit for abdominal pain, something fairly common, and this person went to the ER for abdominal pain. Their total bill was something in the order of $24,000.
Yeah, it was expensive.
Something about that, something in five figures, and had they been seen by the direct to primary care
in his office
in Dr. Gross's office
with the same services.
And again, that's an important point. This isn't a reduced
apples and oranges.
Right. This is the same test, the same labs, the same care down to the letter, and it was
under $300.
Yes. So, you're talking about a, 100 to 1? No, 10 to 1, not even.
It's ridiculous.
50 to 1 difference.
It's the overpriced care in the hospitals, and Steve Brill wrote about that in Time Magazine in March of 2014. He rewrote an article about his $190,000 heart bypass surgery a couple weeks ago in Time Magazine. So this is a huge prediction that I'm making. I'm gonna throw the ball to you, Mike, because another big prediction is going to be changes in IT with what Mayo Clinic and Apple are doing.
Yes, and there is a huge groundswell happening at the consumer level, at the patient level. And this is really where it needs to come from, Hal. It needs to come from the bottom up with, you know, consumer demand that will select the products that are good and let the products that are not so good die a natural death. The big thing that's happening or has happened in 2014 will continue in 2015 is this whole wearable technology concept. You know, people are buying Fitbits and bands and these sorts of things in droves because the price is right, you know, for an impulse purchase, right? This, the Microsoft band or a Fitbit costs you between $100 and $200. If that were an official device that was approved by the FDA and paid for by insurance, it'd be $2,000, not $200.
Right.
So we have wearables, we have app-driven stuff, we have stuff happening in your cell phone, whether, you know, that communicates with a sensor that's on your body and can deliver data, you know, to your provider. And so to that end, there has been announced back in June a collaboration between Apple Computer and the Mayo Clinic. So you bring two big names together, one from the IT universe, one from the healthcare universe, and each one gives a large amount of credibility and brand recognition to the other. So what they've done is at the app level, you know, in your cell phone, that the Mayo Clinic app, which already existed and already apparently had a very functional, usable patient portal on there that you could communicate with your private providers in a secure fashion. You could see your clinic notes, lab data, etc. And they've married that to Apple's new application that's simply called Health, which has the ability to look at the wearables that you wear and look at sensors on your smartphone, see how well you're exercising, and marry that to the services that are available through the Mayo Clinic, so that you now have the best of both worlds working in one app in your smartphone.
And I understand that they're also working on a more user-friendly electronic medical record so that they can – right now what we have are – it's the Wild West where you have all of these inadequate, just horrible electronic medical records that
right.
that don't speak to other applications, and it's you know, so what we're finding is that if Apple can come up with an electronic medical record, and I have no doubt that they can't,
somebody's
can't
working on it. It's somebody.
As I've said before, you'll have doctors who are screaming about electronic medical records now lined up outside Apple.
You bet.
Before it hits the door.
Yep. Guarantee you that. I'm very confident of that. So another thing I like that they're doing is they're starting slow. Right? All they've done at this point is marry the applications. They haven't added any new functionality yet. They're just kind of getting it together, see how it works. It's sort of the opposite of the meaningful use approach. Instead
right.
of forcing it to happen too fast, they're taking their time. It looks like they're going to do well. So we're at the top of the hour.
We are winding down. We have more to talk about, which we're not going to get to. But this was a lot of fun, a great show. I think it's a good recap. I'd like to once again thank David Moxley for his support of this show and
yes,
our
indeed.
Audience for
yes,
listening. Indeed. And it's been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to a great 2015 with you, Mike.
You're listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for